Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inch. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have back here on the program Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He joins us once a month. It's always on a Monday. And we talk about home maintenance. This is the opportunity for you to call in. Maybe you got some kind of problem. Something needs to be fixed. Or you're thinking about doing some remodeling. You have questions about windows, doors, siding, gutters, roofs, insulation, attic, basement, anything at all that has to do with a single-family home, you just pick up the telephone and give us a call. And I know Scott will do his best to help you out. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. And we do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. 333-9455, here for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Thanks very much for being here.
Morning, David. Glad to be here.
Things are now where it's sort of going back and forth here between being warm and being cold. So we don't quite know exactly what season it is, but I think that probably a lot of people already now have had their furnace on, maybe at least a little bit. It's been cool enough so that I think probably most people have. Anything that you would say just in general terms that people should think about in terms of maintenance, for example, do you think that it's periodically a good idea for you to have your furnace inspected?
Well, of course, it's always a good idea to have a furnace man come out there, if not once a year, once every 2 years. If you get it at the right time of year, they can actually check both the air conditioning and furnace at the same time. It gets a little too cold to check air conditioners. They can't do that, but they can just do a performance check to make sure you're operating it at your peak efficiency so you're not wasting any fuel. And, of course, it's also a good time when you're switching from air conditioning to heating to remember to change that air filter if you haven't changed it recently.
Yeah.
So just a quick reminder on that as well.
Is there anything that your average homeowner can do to determine whether or not the furnace is operating properly?
Well, not a lot. Generally, if the furnace is doing something strange, like constant cycling, and that would be where the furnace seems to want to run quite a bit, and you can hear the burner fire and then shut back down and then fire back up, so you get some odd noises, or it seems to be running more than it should for the amount of heat you're getting, or the fan doesn't shut off, little things like that. Mm-hmm. You get one that gets dirty and you may not get enough airflow through it. And then the burner actually overheats the heat exchanger, so it shuts off on the high limit switch. So the fan will stay running. It'll shut the burner down. So that's one of the more common ones. But for the most part, with the new electronic controls on these high-efficiency furnaces, we don't have all that many that type of issues. Usually, if there's a problem, it shuts everything down pretty quick, and you end up having no heat. So it's a pretty dead giveaway that you need to get somebody out there.
Yeah. Because of the costs, people, I think, are trying to keep their thermostats set low and as they can and continue to be comfortable.
Right. And that's not a bad way of saving energy, because there's a general rule of thumb that for every degree you set your thermostat down, you save approximately 3% on your fuel bills. Depending on the efficiency of your house, of course, that varies. So like I said, that's a very, very wide general rule. Things you can do to make yourself more comfortable with less heat in the house. Sweaters, heavier clothing. Move your major furniture away from windows. Your body acts as a radiant heater, and you tend to radiate heat towards a cool surface. So if you spend a lot of time in the house anywhere where there is a cool area, such as a large window or a doorway or something like that, you're going to be less comfortable in the house, so therefore you're going to want to turn the thermostat up a little bit. Mm-hmm. So you can actually be more comfortable by rearranging the furnishings in the house, the beds away from the outside walls, things like that.
Okay. And just I know this is one of the questions often we get during the wintertime, particularly when it's really cold, is that if I'm going to set back my thermostat, how far back does it make sense to do that? And then there's this issue of, well, okay, so you're not at home during the daytime. You set it way back. It's freezing in the house when you get home. So then what you want to do, well, obviously you want to set it up to get it warmed up. And then, in fact, you might not be saving as much money as you would be as if you just tried to keep it at a fairly even temperature all the time.
You're absolutely correct, particularly with most of the newer homes, anything built within the last 20 to 25 years where we had quite a bit of insulation in them. You turn it down for 6 to 8 hours while you're gone at work. And really, the house shouldn't drop far enough to actually hit your setback. If you try and set it back 6 or 8 degrees, the house may not drop that full 6 to 8 degrees except in extreme weather. And during extreme weather, those are the times where you really don't want to set it back that far, because then it does take twice as long to come back up, because the furnace has to heat the mass of the house rather than just the air. Because if you let it sit too long, then your furnishings get cold, the walls, the floors, and everything else, and it just takes a while for the furnace to catch back up. So usually I don't recommend more than about a 4 to maybe 6 degree setback. That way the furnace will come on once or twice and keep everything in about the right temperature, so when you come back home and it needs to bump back up, it doesn't sit there and run forever.
Uh-huh. Well, we have a caller here. We'd welcome others. If you'd like to talk with Scott Spies, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222. 9455. Caller is first caller here is in Geneva on our toll free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Hey, good morning. Good topic. I happen to be doing some research. I'm going to build hopefully in another maybe 8, 7, 8, 9 years another house, and I want it to be. I'm trying to get it to where it's almost independent of public utilities. Basically, heating it with air conditioning and heating that is. Separate from the online, but that's what my call is about. Is there heating and cooling systems out there that you can use, say, for instance, that's more efficient, like a solar heating maybe? Something I could use other than just strictly going through utilities?
Well, yes. However, in the Champaign area, it's not quite as effective as it is in other areas. In other words, we don't have the solar gain that they would have, say, up in the mountains or some of the southern areas. We've got a little bit too much ozone blocking the UV rays of the sunlight, so we're not picking up as much. So it's not quite as efficient here. They tried doing a lot of work here at the University of Illinois at the Small Homes Council on solar water heaters and solar panels and such, and they found that we just didn't have enough gain from the sunlight that we have to really be all that practical. There were a couple of builders, I want to say back in the late 80s, early 90s, we were working with passive solar systems, and they work quite well. They basically are building a house, then building an envelope on the outside of the house and putting a southern exposure with a lot of glass on the south side of the house, letting that room pick up heat, and then taking that heat and circulating it with fans around the outside of the envelope, in other words, up over the top of the house and then back down through special areas in the basement or in the crawl space. And it worked out quite well. The disadvantage of one of these envelope houses or one of these passive solar houses would be, in case of fire, there is air control all the way around the house. So if there's a fire, you get out very quickly because the house isn't going to last long. Generally speaking, in this area, there's been a lot of research in it, and there's been a lot of people looking into it, and I haven't found anything that I can just say, here's my seal of approval, let's stamp it and say, let's go and turn off the power to the power company.
How about just a combination, though? That's what I'm looking at, because I'm figuring you can't totally get off of one thing completely without using a combination of 2 or 3 or 4.
You're absolutely correct, and one of the ones that going around now that seems to be working relatively well is some of these geothermal heat pump systems. We're actually using the heat in the ground to help heat the house, and they are pretty efficient. The downside to those are they're quite costly for initial installation. When you're doing the building of the house, it probably doubles or almost triples the heating. Installation, and if you've already got an existing house, then of course it's quite a bit more to upgrade or to change over to the geothermal. But they are more efficient, and you can use that geothermal along with some type of, I want to say, a passive solar to actually put a bunch of panels up and stuff on the house. It just doesn't seem to be working as well as what the cost ratio would be.
Thank you. If there's any more info out there, where do I get that? I'll get off and listen. Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you. I don't have a direct source for that. My guess is you could do some quick searches on the internet. We do have the University of Illinois Small Homes Council, Building Research Council here on the U of I campus that has done quite a bit with residential research. rather than doing it more for commercial. So that's a good source for a little bit of anything and everything, and they can probably direct you in the towards what you might want to consider.
Yeah, it sounds like if you took advantage of passive solar in your design, if your house was appropriately insulated, if your appliances like your furnace and your air conditioner were high efficiency, you did everything you could to make your use of energy as efficient as possible, you might not be able to completely disconnect from the power company, but you could go a long way to keeping your energy bill as low as it could possibly be.
Yeah, what we have to run into is keeping the energy bill low, but if it costs us $5 to save $2, I'm not sure that a lot of people are willing to spend the extra money to make sure that, hey, I don't have to turn my heat on until it gets 30 degrees outside, but it ended up costing you three times as much as what you actually would have spent just trying to keep you from spending that amount.
Yeah, so I suppose part of the issue is how long do you think you're going to live in that house?
Yeah, how cost efficient is it going to be over a given time frame?
Yeah, all right. Let's talk with somebody else here. Gibson City, line number one. Hello.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a high-efficiency Linux furnace and, vents out the side, and there's a little fan that kind of clears that tube before the furnace kicks on, and sometimes I get a smell of natural gas when it first clears that pipe. Is that normal for some of the high-efficiency furnaces?
To get a gas smell, no, that is not normal on the high-efficiency units. The fan that comes on is what they call the induction fan, and its intent is to actually create a draw or draft through the furnace before the burner kicks on. So there's actually a low pressure or almost a vacuum switch inside the furnace that says, okay, yes, we do have a draw. We have a low pressure inside the heat exchanger, so we can go ahead and fire the burner, and the exhaust gases will be exiting the house. There should be absolutely no gas in the furnace until after that fan has already established a proper draft or draw through the furnace. So it's one of those things where if you may be getting a smell, but I don't know if that's it. The other thing is occasionally if you've got a water heater in the same room with that fan, if there's not enough makeup, that induction fan could actually draw a little bit of flue gases out of the water heater. So you need to make sure that wherever room that furnace is in, there's enough combustion air. If it draws from outside, that helps. But if it draws from that furnace room, you need to make sure that there's enough makeup air for that furnace room.
Water heater's in a whole different area. I thought perhaps maybe the furnace was shutting down the flame, but maybe the valve was still releasing a little gas, and then the next time it kicks on, it cleared that gas. But if that's not normal, I'll get somebody to come and look at it.
Yeah, I would say that definitely was not a normal odor to have a gas smell before or after the furnace.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Again, questions are welcome. This is the show that we do here every month to give you a chance to ask questions about home maintenance issues. That's the dad. Hank Spies was here for a long time. Scott Spies is here now, and he's an inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. And one of the Spieses, has been here doing the show with us for a long time. And we continue to do it because we get a lot of questions, and people say they appreciate having the chance to get some advice on dealing with problems around the home. So if that is the case, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Anything else that you would suggest to people do now that we're in a kind of a transitional season here in between when we get our hottest temperatures and when we get our coldest temperatures?
We're getting our big swings right now, and usually it's a good idea not to necessarily open the window the first chance you get. Oh, well, look at how nice it is. You open the window and let a lot of humidity in, because you never know the next day the temperature may drop and you've got that much humidity in the house, and all of a sudden it drops down to 20 degrees outside or 40 degrees and your humidity level in your house is excessive. You end up with condensation in the attic or in the walls, things like that. So you kind of want to refrain from opening the windows on the real humid days. Now, I realize that Hank, my father, is very adamant on not ever opening a window.
Yes.
And while I don't open windows in my house on a regular basis, I'm also not a proponent of living inside of a plastic bag and never opening the Ziploc. So a little bit of fresh air here and there once in a while is not necessarily a bad idea. Just pick the days that you do it on where the humidity levels aren't aren't excessive.
Yeah, that's, I think, particularly his thing there is during the summertime. If we have a long period where it's really hot and humid, the house is closed, you have your air conditioning on, and you know, you get to feeling like, yeah, you're living in a bottle. And then when it gets nice enough outside that you say, gee, what I'd really like to do is open the windows, you do that. But and the thing that you have to consider is that if you do have central air, what you're doing, you are, yes, letting in fresh air, and it may be cool enough so that you're comfortable, but you're also letting in a lot of humidity. And over the course, if you have your windows then open for a couple of days, then you're letting in all this humidity. So then it suddenly gets hot again, and you say, I guess we better turn on the air conditioner. Well, what he would say is that you have to consider that what your air conditioner has to do then is pump out all of the moisture that has come in when the windows are open. So he would say, well, you know, you're spending more money there that you would not have if you hadn't let all that extra moisture in. That's his point.
Now, the primary job of a central air conditioner in this area is that of dehumidification. And so if it's got the house at a good humidity level, and then all of a sudden you start opening the windows and doors and raising it, then of course it has to work harder to cool the house back down. And it's, again, one of these perceived comfort factors. A house at 80 degrees and relatively dry may feel as comfortable or more comfortable than a house at 77 degrees that has a higher humidity level. Mm-hmm. So it kind of depends on how you like your house set and what you're willing to deal with.
All right. Let's talk with somebody else here, Bloomington, Illinois. This is line number 4, toll-free line.
Morning.
Yes, hi.
I have a house that was built in the 1920s. It's a two-story house, so it has a lot of surface area exposed to the outdoors. It has a brick exterior and plaster walls inside and no insulation in between them. Is there some economically viable way that I could insulate those walls?
Yes, there is, actually. Usually they'll blow in either a cellulose or a mineral wool or a fiberglass insulation with a brick exterior, provided you've got I'm going to have to go out on a limb here and say a competent insulation installer. They should be able to cut one brick out at the top, over the top of a stud, probe in on either side of the stud, and fill the wall cavity on either side. So they would only need to take a brick out at every stud level. Now, if you're planning on doing any renovation or remodeling inside the house, they could also come in inside, drill the holes in the plaster, and blow it into the wall cavities. But really, blowing in is about the only way to do it on an existing structure like that. And the brick veneer does make it a little bit more difficult, but it still can be done.
Would it be less expensive to do it from the inside?
Oftentimes it's less expensive, but you have to stop and think, okay, who's going to do my plaster repair? Because it's getting more and more difficult to get somebody that can do good plaster work, and you really don't want to have a bunch of polka dots every 30 inches around your room inside the house.
How would I go about finding a competent installer?
Well, you have to call them up and ask them a couple questions and see how they answer questions, or have them come out and take a look at things and see what, you know, just kind of see what they're looking at and how they're acting when they look at this brick with, oh, that's no problem, or, well, I don't know if we can get this taken care of here. So it's one of those things where you kind of feel it out.
Uh-huh. If I called you off the air, would you be able to recommend someone?
Well, if you're welcome to call the office, my father has a list of people that he uses, but over in I believe in Bloomington was your call. I don't know that I've got anybody over there that I've got on my list.
Okay. Well, thank you for the information.
All right, thanks for the call.
Enjoying the show.
We're going to take a break here, and then we'll continue to talk with our guest, Scott Spies, from the Spies Home Inspection Service. This is our monthly show on home inspection. This is also our fall fundraising effort here on WILL Radio. You know, if we were doing this the way that we did it for a long time, this would be the very first weekday that we'd be asking for contributions. Well, we have tried to shorten up our pledge drives, and that means that this is actually the next to the last. We'll be here today and tomorrow, and that's it. It's a 5-day drive. We've made it shorter. Our goal is $200,000, and I'm sure that we can get an update here in the moment. We'll see how we're doing. But because the drive is shorter, that means we can't just take our time on this. We have to move along as fast as we can and get as many people to call in as we possibly can so that we can meet that goal. And you can help. If you haven't yet made a contribution, why don't you do that right now? You can call us. Two numbers here I want to give you. First is if you're in Champaign-Urbana, 244-9455. If you're going to make a long-distance call, if it would be a long-distance call, we have a toll-free line. So the call's on us, and that is 866-779-9455. Either way, if you listen to WILL, we also want you to be a supporter. You can do that right now. Jack Brighton is here in the studio with me. He is the guy who oversees our web effort, something that over the years has grown considerably.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And all the archives of this show and all the other local shows are on our website anytime. You can download those or stream them. Information about the shows coming up there as well. I wanted to just mention how well things are going with this fund drive, this shortened fund drive. We want to keep it really short, so we do encourage you to keep that momentum going. We had an incredible response this morning on Morning Edition. I think over 70 people called during the Guido's Challenge, which put an extra $1,000 on the table. Actually, it allowed us to pick it up off the table. And so thank you, everyone, for contributing to that. But we need to keep going here, keep the pedal going on this fund drive by calling 244-9455 in support of Focus 580. I want to check in with Martha Deal, who's one of your producers. You've got two very excellent producers who work incredibly hard to keep this show going, the Afternoon Magazine going, and see how things are going in Pledge Central. Martha, can you update us on our total and so forth?
Well, as you said, Jack, we had a really banner bust-out time this morning, and we are now at $148,219. And you're right, those 70 callers put us up to 814 pledges, and we're now at 100 new members. Not quite halfway to our goal of 250 new members by the close of business on Tuesday or close of pledge drive. So we're asking listeners to call WILL with a contribution. The volunteers are having a lovely conversation with Heather, but we'd really appreciate you picking up the phone, 244-9455 or toll-free 866-779-9455 or willpledge.org so that we can keep David talking with all those wonderful authors and guests who come to campus.
Keep him working hard.
Yes.
It's really important that we hear from new people because we know a lot of people move to the area every year. You may have discovered we're your NPR station, you know, whereas before it was some other place, some other station, and maybe you remember there. We're asking you to become a member here, too, because we really need you on board. A lot of people move away, et cetera, so there's a constant change in the population here. We want to make sure that you know we're here for you, and to hope you are also here for us. 244-9455, that's the local number, toll-free 866-779-9455, or just go online to willpledge.org.
All right, thank you very much. We have some callers here we'd like to get to, and others are welcome to call in with questions about home maintenance. That's the thing that we're doing here this morning. We do this program every month, once a month. It's always on a Monday. Have been doing that for a long, long time. Our guest is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. And as I say, always say, whatever it is, if it's gutters or roofing or basements or attics or doors or windows or insulation or whatever, heating and cooling, any of those kinds of questions, you give us a call. And I know Scott will do his best to help you out. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And our next caller is here in Urbana, where we are, line one. Hello.
Good morning. It's
yes.
Not gutters. It's a furnace and air conditioning.
All right. Well, that's okay, too.
I'm putting in a high-efficiency furnace, and now I'm trying to choose which air conditioning unit, and I've got a SEER of 15 or an SEER of 16 with a two-stage condensing unit, and there's a $400 difference between the two.
Okay, well, the SEER, or Seasonal Energy Efficiency Rating, is pretty much a number of BTUs of cooling per watt of electricity. So if you have a SEER of 15, you're getting 15 BTUs of cooling per watt of electricity versus the other one, which is getting 16 BTUs of cooling per watt of electricity. So, yes, it is a little bit more efficient. $400, that is because of the way they're getting these units to be more efficient, the two-stage systems. Actually, that's not a great difference. I don't know. You know, it's one of those things. If you're going to be in the house for long periods of time, the unit is probably good for about 16 to 18 years is what we've been seeing on most air conditioners. So you have to amortize your payback on your $400 over that period. It's an economics type thing. 15 to 16, I doubt you really see much on your power bill. I mean, it's going to be there, but and you're not going to see a lot of it. It's not going to be a $15 a month savings.
Oh, okay.
And a lot depends on how you run your air conditioner. If you're the type that closes all the windows and turns it on in March and turns it off in October, it's more efficient to you to move to the 16. If you're the type of person that waits until the last day in June when it's just unbearable before you turn the air conditioner on, it may not be as cost effective for you.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Next caller is in Chicago. This is line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I live in a building with radiant heat, so there's no way to humidify the air. Does anybody make a portable humidifier that's safe to use, doesn't spit bacteria back in the air?
Well, anytime you've got a pan of water that you're evaporating, you have to make sure that what's in that pan of water has to have some type of algicide in it or something, or it will grow things. So as far as spitting bacteria back in the air, as long as you clean it on a fairly regular basis, that shouldn't be a big issue. There are several different types of humidifiers out there, anything from ones that move air manually with a fan or some that work on convection. The key to a power humidifier, particularly the portable ones, is that you must clean it fairly often. So if the water sits in there for a week, it's amazing what can start to grow in there. So you've got to get in there and throw a little bleach or something in there and kill things off.
Bleach will do it.
Usually a little bit of a bleach solution will do it, yes.
How much water would you need in a normal apartment, like a gallon a day or something like that?
All depends on how airtight the house is. Because what we're doing is we're adjusting relative humidity relative to outdoor humidity. So if it's relatively dry outside, it takes relatively little additional moisture to make the house inside more humid than outdoors. If the humidity level is, let's say it's 20 degrees outside and we've got 20% humidity, we've got to add more moisture in the house to get it higher than that 20% humidity.
But when it is normal on indoors?
People are comfortable in the about the 35 to 50% range.
35 to 50. All right. One more question. On radiant heat, how much of the heat is from the floor and the ceiling above in the next apartment?
Generally speaking, heat above you in a heated space is not going to affect you much. Now you're saying radiant heat. Are we floor radiant heat? Are we ceiling radiant heat?
Well, the tubing is in the cement flooring.
Okay.
And the ceiling above is the apartment above.
Okay.
So tenants, they make a beeline for the valve in the ceiling. And I said, that's the guy above you.
Yeah. The amount of heat coming from the ceiling is not going to radiate as much. What it does is it puts a warm barrier up there, so when you're walking around, your head is warmer, so you're more comfortable in the room. A lot of times, as we get older and our hair starts thinning out a little bit, it's amazing how much less tolerant we are to temperature changes because our bodies do radiate heat out. So, yes, it does help. It not necessarily that it's helping to heat the air, but as much as it is to help insulate you from a cooler surface.
Feels good. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Yeah. Well, your mom said wear a hat, you'll feel warmer. She was right about that.
That's right. There is a lot of heat loss through your head. I had a friend of mine who was bald, and he was really good at finding missing insulation in a ceiling. You'd find a really cold day, and he'd walk through here, and he's, boy, this room's cold. And I'm sitting there going, no, it's not really cold. Go up in the attic. Sure enough, they only had about 3 inches insulation over the top of the room. So it's how your body radiates that heat out and how you feel comfortable. You know, as I said earlier, an extra jacket or a sweater, rather, wearing sweats instead of shorts, things like that will make the house a little bit more comfortable.
Yeah. All right. Next caller is in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
I'm looking at doing one of two home improvement projects, either adding insulation in the walls or replacing the windows. I have about a 70-year-old home with the original windows in it. Where is my money better spent? Is it in the windows or in the walls?
In my opinion, in that case, it's in the insulation in the walls. I don't have a problem with 70-year-old windows. 70-year-old windows can be fairly easily modified to where they are a lot more energy efficient. They can get they make kits to where you can weather strip the sides and put a good lock on it. A good wood single pane window with a storm window is relatively good in efficiency, even compared to some of these new thermal temperature controlled coated glass, double hung, double glazed, triple glazed windows. Really, what we're looking for is air leakage. The glass itself, there's not a whole lot you can do to change the thermal transfer through the glass. By putting a storm window on it so we don't have moving air past your prime windows, you're going to be pretty efficient. On that particular house, my guess is the walls are your cold spots. Yes, it feels like it's cold around the window because the window's just a little bit cooler in the wall, so the cold air from the window falls down, and it always feels like there's a draft below the window. But insulating the walls, I think, will do the most for your money on this one.
Now, if there's an existing bat within the wall that is a, you know, probably a very thin bat because they didn't insulate houses very well 7 years ago, do I have any options or am I out of luck as far as doing blown-in insulation?
If there is a bat in the wall, the blown-in insulation does not work well because the bat is not tight against one wall or another. It tends to wiggle all the way down. There's kind of got a wavy action, and so the insulation doesn't blow in. In that particular case, about the only thing you can do is some exterior insulation. If you do some siding on the house, would be to put, you know, if you're going to re-side the old siding, you end up putting a foam insulation on the exterior and putting your new insulation over the top of that. But if you've already got insulation in the wall, then that's a big plus right there. You might check and see how much you've got in the attic to see what kind of heat loss you've got.
Okay. Thanks very much.
All right. Other calls are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Just, you, or there's something else you want to
mention? Yeah, I was just thinking, there was a short time when we had access to an infrared camera, which we would take to a home in a cold weather, and we could actually do a photograph of the house and find the heat loss areas, and it was kind of interesting. You could find insulation misting in a wall about the size of a softball or a baseball and see the cold spots. So it's kind of interesting to see, you know, hey, where is my heat loss? And with insulation in the walls, really the walls seem to be pretty tight. Yes, you always had the glass was a heat loss and usually around a door. But most of your heat loss was, of course, heat wanting to go up. Heat rises. Mm-hmm. And most of it is through the attic. So extra insulation in the attic, if you've already got some of the walls, is probably your best bet.
Yeah. And for people who do think that it's cold around the windows, how much could this be cold air that's coming in around the window, around the edges of the rough opening? That is, when they put in a window, they got to cut a hole for the window to fit in, so they put the window in there. So there's going to be some little space right all around the edge of the window that if you don't do something about, you may get cold air coming in there.
Yeah, windows have two characteristics when it comes to that. Yes, you get some air moving around the casings. Generally, when they put the window in, they're supposed to put an insulator, stuff foam backer rod or some fiberglass insulation between the rough framing and the window frame. So hopefully that stops the direct airflow. But the windows will always feel a little cooler underneath them just because of convection. As the glass gets colder, the air next to the glass gets cold. Cold air falls down. So you've got a cool air coming down the sill, and you've got warm air coming from above. If you've got a casement window or something with a screen on it, you may want to take the screen off because that allows the air to move past the window a little bit faster. Keeps the temperature of the window a little bit closer to the room temperature, so it's not quite as cold around the windows. Mm. Or it doesn't feel as cold. I mean, the temperature in the room may not be much different, but if you get close to a window that's got a screen on it, it actually feels colder.
Okay. Other callers here. Chatsworth is the next, and this is line 4, the toll-free line.
Yes, good morning.
Yes, hello.
Yes, I have a problem with basement flooding. Whenever there's a heavy rain, the Great Lake forms out in the street, and pretty soon the water's gushing up from the old floor drain and in an old capped-off sewer connection down in the basement. I've had as much as a foot of water, and that's with the sump pump running steadily. I hate to think what would happen if the power went out at the same time. I've had as much as a foot. It seems unlikely that the small town here will ever do anything much about this, and it's getting worse. So my idea is to dig up the sewer, the old storm sewer, as close, or the connection to the storm sewer, as close to the street as possible, and cut that connection. Is there any problem there other than, of course, the floor drain won't drain anymore?
Actually, no, that's about the only way to do something like that. When the street starts filling and the yard starts filling, you're obviously in an area where we don't have a good drainage.
Yes. that's our area.
Yeah, and so when you have a low spot, such as a basement, in one of those areas, then definitely it is kind of an issue. I have seen several times where it does help to find where the water, which direction the water is coming from. Dig down, if you've got a tile or something, dig out away from the footing, cut or break that tile, cap it off as best as possible. And then before you fill your hole back in, actually put a plastic barrier on the towards the house side, and then put your dirt back in, and you end up putting a little bit of a liner between the moisture source and the soil that's next to your basement. In other words, just throw a sheet of plastic down the hole. If you digging all the way down, particularly around a drain pipe or something that's coming into the house, you're digging not necessarily a hole, but more of a trench. Just let some plastic go all the way to the bottom of the trench and come back up partway before you put your dirt in there. And that way, if that drain pipe that you've capped off leaks, that water doesn't run towards your old drain pipe. And as you mentioned, yes, your floor drain is no longer going to work, but they do make some really nice standalone sewage ejection pump systems for like your laundry and things like that would most people connect to those lower level drains.
Mm-hmm. So okay, I have a plumbing and heating guy who's willing to take a shot at it, so I guess I'll let him try.
Yeah, in that particular case, when you've got that much surface water, it's one of those things where you got to try and do your best to prevent it from getting your direction. So working on the outside is always better than working on the inside.
Okay. Well, thank you for your help.
All right, thank you.
Goodbye.
And next, back here to someone in Champaign, line 1. Hello.
Hi, I'm wondering if you're familiar with any of these. They're called like defog it for double pane windows. You know, we have a number of like 3 or 4 in a series of quite large windows on a south facing wall. And I understand that, you know, the insulating properties of the double pane are still fine, but the seals have broken, so some of them look just kind of dirty. And occasionally, if you just get the right combination of cold, hot, moisture, sometimes we'll get a little bit of fogging in a pane or two. But do you know anything about these companies that claim that they can defog that, and is that successful, or do we just have to either replace them entirely or live with it?
Well, I'm going to have to admit to pleading ignorant on this one. I'm not familiar with those companies. I haven't seen those any good way of doing that is cost effective. Since you're talking about large panes, it might be more helpful. As a general rule, a fog pane is usually about $100 to $150 to replace, and by the time you send somebody over to your house and do anything to the window and spend any time on it, they're going to charge you almost that much to correct an old window. Mm-hmm. If you've got one that's got a bad seal, then you've probably got the seal is probably not just bad in one area. It's probably beginning to deteriorate in several areas, so patching one section may or may not help. That's something I will go home and do some research. That's one of the item that I'm not up on at the moment.
Okay. I believe what they do is just drill holes or something. I don't know. But I can't imagine that that's going to do anything in our case. I don't know.
Well, what happens is when you've got a sealed double glazed glass for maximum insulation, they do remove the air, and they usually put in an inert gas of some type, and then they seal that in there so that there's no moisture in the window. Once the seal has loosened or gotten brittle and cracked, then we can get a little bit of humidity or moisture into that window, and you end up getting almost an etching of the glass on the inside. Mm-hmm. And even though they can reseal the window, there's no way to clean the old window. I mean, if it's got debris on it, and you can't send a little window washer up there and scrub in between there on that quarter inch of air gap.
Yeah.
So that's where they're saying they're not fogging it, or they're defogging it. They maybe will take moisture out, but I really don't think that once the glass has this opaque look or starts getting the little crystals and stuff built in there, I really don't think there's any way that they can clean that.
Yeah, that was kind of my thinking, but I just kind of wondered if you'd heard of it. Also, real quick, in terms of insulating, back to a few callers back, I read something about ceramic paint. Is that effective at all?
Okay, that would be more of a question for my father. He's done a little bit of research on that. It's helpful as a reflective insulation. It all depends on where it's at and what your where your heat source is, whether you're going to reflect heat away from, keep solar gain down. It works well. If you've got a radiant heat source, then it reflects heat back towards you, so it can work well on the inside. Kind of depends on your heating system. Like I said, that'd be a really good question for him. He's done a little bit more research on it. The paints or the reflective systems, yes, they have merit. Question is whether or not they're cost effective.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's continue. And our next caller is going to be in Streeter, and this is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm considering building a home with using an exterior wood burner for heat, radiant heat in the floor with hardwood floors, and I was wondering what your thoughts were on that as a combination.
Well, anytime you have an auxiliary heat source like that, yes, they work. However, your maintenance goes up substantially. In other words, you have to maintain that wood burner on a regular basis. They need cleaning several times a season. They need constant feeding. Yes, you can. Some of them have hoppers where they have automatic feeders. But you've definitely taken a maintenance-free gas system and made it into a high-maintenance heating system where you're always playing with it. So it kind of depends on how much time you're willing to put into it and how much your time is worth as to whether or not it's not just easier to have a separate system.
Okay, and how about the combination with radiant heat and hardwood floors?
Radiant heat works well because it tends to heat the materials in the house as well as the occupants. It's a very comfortable heat. It doesn't have drafts. So as long as you've got the system set up right, it does work well, and it takes away the cold floors and things like that. So, yes, I will say that works well.
I'm assuming tile floors would be even better, but hardwood would work, you think?
Well, the wood will act as a bit of an insulator. You're talking about putting the radiant under the hardwood floor?
Correct, uh-huh.
Okay, I was thinking radiant heat with hardwood when you're using a ceiling heat, because then it actually radiates and heats the floors. I don't know if the wood would act as too much of an insulator. It works well with tile because ceramic and masonry does act as a thermal transfer material, whereas wood is more of a thermal barrier. So I'm not sure that it would work well on a wood floor.
Okay, thank you.
All right, and thank you. And we continue. Next caller here is line number three, and that is someone here in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question is about my attic, and I have insulation up in the floor of the attic. Then I have a window in the south end and another window in the north end, and then I open that window in the summer, and there's a louvered screen, and then there's an attic fan for ventilation to keep it cool. So my question is, do you close the windows in the winter, or do you just leave them open all year round?
If you've got a good amount of insulation in the attic, which you just indicated you had some under the floor, if you've got 6 to 8 inches of insulation or more, then I would say leaving those windows open or closed is not going to make that much of a difference. What you're going to be controlling is not necessarily the temperature in the attic, but the humidity levels in the attic. If an attic gets really cold and you've got high humidity in the house, it's one of the first places that moisture will condense. So good attic ventilation in the wintertime is needed.
So if the windows are open, then the moisture escapes. It doesn't get trapped in the attic?
That is correct.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you don't want it open far enough to where the snow is going to blow in and create moisture problems in the insulation. And if you've only got 3 or 4 inches of insulation up in the attic, in a lot of places where you have floored areas, that's about all they can get in there, then you really don't want to have a lot of air moving over the top of it, because then you get a thermal draft through your insulation. So if you've only got 3 or 4 inches of insulation, I would say probably close the windows. If you've got 6 to 8 or more, the 12 inches that they're putting in now, then the windows being open is not going to affect your heating bill.
So should I close it partially then?
Yeah, I would close it enough that you don't have a lot of snow blow in there. Leave it open an inch or two.
Yeah.
So that we get good ventilation and good cross ventilation through there to keep the humidity levels down.
Because right now it's open all the way. So
yeah, you probably don't want to do that, because we get these beautiful snowstorms around here where we have horizontal snow and it likes to come in, things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you.
All right, we got one more caller here. Someone in Fort Collins, Colorado. You know anybody out there?
Well, actually, you're pretty close to Hank at the moment if you're in Fort Collins.
Is that right?
He's up in Empire doing some building up there this week.
Well, the reason why I'm calling you from Fort Collins is because we were a long-time Champaign residents and listening online, and I haven't found the Scottsby's version out here, so I have to call you.
Well, actually, my brother lives in Summit County, so you're pretty close.
Does he do a show, a call-in show?
At the moment, he does not have a call-in show, but I can set you up with a phone number.
Well, maybe you could take care of my problem.
There you go.
I have a basement that's getting some water in it. This is a house that they with a finished basement, and they put in egress windows downstairs. One window that faces on the north side when it rains. Sometimes that egress window well fills up a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and water seems to be coming in from the wall underneath. And there's not a cover on it right now, and I was going to put that on, and then I wanted to know if there's anything else we can do to try to prevent water from coming in when, on the rare occasion when it rains more than a couple inches here.
Okay, I'm going to say there's about a 99% chance that the window cover is going to do you no help.
Ah.
Because if you were to set a glass out there and rain, it only gets so much, and usually, you know, if you get an inch of rain, you should only have a maximum of an inch of water in the bottom of that window well, and the soil should percolate enough to draw that back down.
Yeah.
If you're getting water standing in the window well, that means there is other areas where the moisture is running towards the house, and it just happens to be collecting where you can see it at that window well. You need to work on your drainage around the exterior, making sure the downspouts are extended to an area where we slope away from that window well, because the window well itself is not going to attract the water. Water blowing in, particularly up against the house and running down, is not enough to fill a window well.
Hmm.
So we need to find out where the water that is filling the window well is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Since it's an egress window, my guess is I don't know how old the house is or how long ago they added the egress windows.
Mm-hmm.
But usually when they dig down and put those windows in, the soil around them is relatively loose and fairly absorbent. And so you have to make sure that even the yard slopes away from that portion of it and the soil is built up enough to provide surface drainage.
Okay, so just try to get back there and put in some soil, fill it in, because it is sort of caved in around that window well.
Yeah,
like
that
the ground has settled around it.
Yep, and that'll do it. What you need to do is build that back up. Once you've got it built up, if you're going to put any landscaping or anything, put some plastic down, but make sure the soil level is built up to where you have a slope away.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll take care of 90% of it.
Okay. Well, right. Thanks a lot.
Well, right,
thanks
for the call. We're going to have to leave it there with our thanks to Scott for being here. It's something we do every month on the show, have for a long, long time, to give folks a chance to call in with questions. And he'll be back next month.
Well, thanks a lot, David. I always have a good time when I come out here, and it's always nice to see the number of callers that we can get.
All right. Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service.